then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your bike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin, eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man, she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's December the 20th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, guys, Christmas is next Tuesday, and I know this week almost all of you are going to be occupied with Christmas stuff in one way or another, and nobody's going to have any time to pay attention to what I'm saying on here. Not that you pay attention to what I'm saying on here anyway, or else you'd already be here in the homeland helping me create a general headquarters unit. And of course, next week is going to be our annual All Music podcast, which I always look forward to every year because I get to be a disc jockey for 2 hours. So I'll tell you what. I'll keep this week's podcast somewhat short and fairly light, and try not to get too heavy on you guys and kill your Christmas buzz, okay? Especially since, no joke, this may be the last real Christmas that any of us have for a long time. No kidding, the situation in this country is now so uncertain and unstable that it's impossible to predict what life may be like a year from now. So enjoy it, because no kidding, after the new year, things all around are going to start getting really grim, and this show's going to have to reflect that fact. Okay, first obvious thing that calls for comment this week is this amazingly convenient school shooting in Connecticut. Now, guys, I've said this before, and I'm going to keep on saying it until you go to Blockbuster or Netflix and you rent a movie from the 1970s called Telephone with Charles Bronson, Lee Remick, and Donald Pleasance. And you will understand what I mean when I say that this Ryan Lanza kid clearly got a call or an email or whatever that told him he had miles to go before he sleeps. No, I'm not just being right-wingy paranoid here. I'm genuinely coming to believe that there's some kind of mind control thing going on with these bizarre and pointless gun massacres, and that it has to do with serving the Democrat agenda and attempting to ban the private ownership and possession of firearms in this country. The timing of these things is just getting too damned convenient, since the Batman shootings hit just before the election, and now we have the Connecticut thing just after. Now, remember the CIA's MK-Ultra 4 experiments, the most well-known of which was the Jim Jones People's Temple mass suicide in Guyana, and also the LSD experiments and whatnot that the regime was conducting back in the 1960s. This is not paranoia and it's not made up. The regime now admits that these things happened. I fail to see why it's so far of a stretch to believe that something is causing certain individuals to go out one day with a semi-auto, blast away in a mall or a school or whatever, and then stick the barrel in their mouth as the cops close in. Always the same pattern of bizarre behavior, which usually makes it impossible to question the killer as to his motives and any strange phone calls or messages he's gotten. On the rare occasions when these guys are caught, all they get is years and years and years of a thousand-yard stare. It's like somebody's gotten into their brain and wiped the hard drive, so to speak. And you notice that these incidents never target anyone of political significance, with the exception of that one loon who popped that Jew Congresswoman, Gabby Giffert. And although the news media suppressed it, Jared Loughner was apparently a Jew himself who had some kind of prior relationship with the Gifford woman. the true details started to come out, and then, needless to say, they just disappeared down the memory hole. That may have been a case of genuine nuttiness as opposed to MK Ultra or whatever is motivating things like the Batman and the Connecticut shootings. Now, of course, the Democrats have the excuse they've been looking for to bring in gun control laws, which will effectively ban semi-autos and any magazine with a capacity of over 5 rounds or so. Kind of take us back to the days before World War I, gun-wise, and all us white boys will be allowed to own, for a time, will be bolt-action rifles and double-barrel shotguns and revolvers. And then, of course, the next step is they'll come for the revolvers. This is what the communists call the salami slicer technique, shaving our rights away thin slice after thin slice. And if they can't get it through Congress, so what? The dictator will just sign an executive order to the BATFE to start arresting people at gun shows and closing gun stores and coming to people's houses to take away their semi-autos and their magazines. They actually did that in California under Clinton, you know. Came to people's houses and demanded that they hand over their guns. You see, during his first term, the dictator discovered that he can get away with that he can rule by decree and no one will do anything about it, like when he ordered the Dream Act into force by executive order after Congress rejected it twice. Now, I'm surprised he's bothering to talk to the Republicans at all about the fiscal cliff. He doesn't have to. All he needs to do is sign executive orders to the IRS and the Federal Reserve to eliminate the Bush tax cuts and raise the debt limit. Why should he not? Who's going to stop him? The Republicans in the House still have the numbers to impeach him, but they don't have the balls. Obama can do anything he wants now, including amnesty the 30 million illegal aliens and give them the vote, again, by decree. And once the Beaners get the vote, he's in power for good. He can simply ignore the 22nd Amendment then and run for a third or fourth term, whatever he wants to do. That's why he's called a dictator. The one constitutional means that we have of getting rid of a president who has turned into a dictator is impeachment, and that's meaningless so long as we are a one-party state, which is what we became on November the 6th, 2012. Oh, another charming little development. Facebook is now disabling accounts that question the official version of the school shootings, and the Connecticut State Police are threatening to prosecute anyone who, quote-unquote, spreads misinformation and engages in, quote-unquote, unseemly speculation about the Sandy Creek school shootings. In other words, anyone who questions the official account of what happened or who points out any inconsistencies in the official story. Okay, I don't want to take up the whole first part of this show with Connecticut or gun control, because it looks like that's going to be the first item on the dictatorship's agenda when Congress comes back after Christmas, but let's take a minute to deal with this old wheeze about, they'll take my gun when they pry it from my cold, dead fingers, and all that crap about how, if they come to my door, I'm going to resist, Harold. I swear it. I really will lock and load and fire on the dictatorship's armed men. Boo-rah! Blah, 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 blah. No, you won't. And we both know it. When they come, you will answer the door and hang your head and mumble and shuffle. Maybe even glare at the thugs in the body armor a bit, but this is it now. This is the real world. Daddy has come to take your toys away because you're a bad little white boy and you can't be trusted to play nice with them. And so while you may yell and stomp your feet and wave your little fisties in the air a bit, we all know damned well that you're going to give Daddy all your bad toys and he will put them in a truck and take them away forever. Because if you don't, Black Daddy might get mad. And he might yell at you and hurt you, and we mustn't ever make Black Daddy mad. I mean, not really, because niggers are big and mean, and they hurt. And once Daddy takes your toys away, you're going to go off into a corner and swill beer or whiskey, and you will cry because Daddy is so mean to you. Come on, guys, we all know that's the way it's going to go. We're talking the real world now here, not some silly bumper sticker that you put on your truck to swagger and act like you be big and bad. I've seen big and bad in Rhodesia and South Africa and Ireland, and guys, you ain't it. I think we all understand that if white males were ever going to do anything by way of actually using all those guns in our closets, then we would have done so long before now. Okay, granted, if and when it gets down to the confiscation stage like it did in California back in the Clinton years, some of you may go so far as to go and hide your guns and bury them in the woods in an oil drum someplace where they will rust away just like they've been rusting away now in your closet for all these years, and where you can't get at them even if you did have the courage to use them. And so they will be just as effectively silenced and decommissioned as if the BATFE had come to your door and taken them away. The regime doesn't give a damn about little white children in Connecticut schools or anywhere else getting murdered by whack jobs. The regime wants all white people dead, and as far as the dictator and his slaves are concerned, killing those kids in Connecticut was probably a good start. The evil people who rule us want to make sure that no bullets from your guns are ever fired at them. And for that purpose, being buried in the ground or hidden in a barn someplace is almost as effective as their being confiscated by their guerrillas. Now, so long as those guns are not loaded and physically in the hands of white men who are no longer afraid of our government and who are willing to act, that's what they want to prevent from happening, and so long as that's not the case, they're good with it. They don't care if you hide all your guns or bury them in the woods or stick your tongue out at them. Just so long as the guns are buried and not in the hands of white men who might use them to create change. Okay, now, before you guys start pelting me with emails, screaming and hollering about, no, 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 you will all be brave and lion-hearted and Rambo-like when the BATFE comes for your guns, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. Just don't, okay? I've been hearing this for 40 years now, and with a tiny number of exceptions that I can count on the fingers of one hand, nothing. Okay, if you fucking insist, maybe a few will resist when the criminals in the black body armor come for their guns, but they will all be very old codgers, probably older than me. Men who were born and raised in different times, when white men actually did things. And all they'll accomplish will be to die in their burning homes and cheat the nursing home out of a few years of fees. Okay, I said no heavy stuff, and this is getting a bit depressing, so here's Gretchen the Librarian to depress you even more with her first personal encounter with Obamacare.
Tonight I want to talk about a certain situation in my own life that may also be happening to some other people. I really found it very alarming. Sometime back in October, I think it was, I got this letter from my health care provider, and it was just talking about some additions to my health care policy, and I looked it over, and there didn't seem to be anything on it that really applied to me or my concerns, so I just sort of put it aside, but I kept it. Then a little while later, I read it and still didn't find anything in it that was of interest to me in terms of my own needs. So I put it aside, but then I started getting these phone calls. The first couple of calls, I didn't answer the phone, but a relative of mine answered the phone, and from what I understood, the phone call about this letter. So I wasn't really sure what I was supposed to do about this letter because I just wasn't interested or didn't need any of the things the letter talked about. But I said, well, apparently they wanted me to join their website, so... Okay, I joined my health insurance company's website, and I know a lot of places have websites today. I know my doctor's office has a website. So, all right, I did that. Then they called again, and this time I was around, and I ended up being able to get on the phone. And first I thought, well, okay, it's going to be about the stuff in this letter, so if they're asking me questions or something, it's going to have something to do with this letter. But then they start asking all these questions, these survey questions, that seem to have nothing to do with the letter. And they're basically asking the same questions over and over, like they do with surveys, to make sure that they're getting your honest response, so they keep rephrasing everything. you know, they're asking me all these very detailed questions, and it just keeps getting more and more redundant, more tedious, more detailed. And based on my answers, they said, well, we've enrolled you in this program. And then they gave me this number and the serial number and a phone number. And I said, well, I'm going to keep these numbers because I think I'll want to opt out of this program. And I'm thinking to myself, these questions are so intense that honestly, I think these people are going to want to come to my house and inspect my house because I've never had a line of questioning like this. And at one point I was asking myself, well, who are these people? Are they really my healthcare company? Because the questions they were asking me had nothing to do with the letter. And I'm thinking, you know, what is this? And so the next day I called my doctor's office. And I said, I have this question about my health insurance. And I said, you know, it's not an emergency or anything, but can he please call me back? And he was away apparently on some kind of a Thanksgiving vacation. So they said, well, he'll call you back in a week. So in a week he calls me back and he says, yes. They're keeping track of people now that have your condition. And he said, they'll come to your house. And I said, thank you very much. I'll take that under advisement. So I was right. It turns out they're coming to people's homes now. So I try to figure out how am I going to cancel this, and they're giving me all these numbers to press on the phone because they have an automated answering system. So finally I figure out, well, how can I cancel it, and I was able to cancel, but this nurse still called me, and I'm kind of glad she did because I learned more about the program. She said that they were going to, if I accepted this program, and when I said no, she was kind of flabbergasted because this nurse kept telling me about this program and I kept saying that I was canceling it and that I'd already canceled it. I'd already called them and I told them I was canceling this program. But she was telling me, oh, we're going to have a social worker and a nurse and a nutritionist. And they're all going to come to your house and they inspect your premises and they talk to you about your habits and all these things, all these personal things. And when we think you're ready to graduate from the program, you can leave the program. So apparently you can graduate and you can leave this program, but it's very invasive. And on an intellectual level, I understand why they're doing it and I understand it's cutting costs for them. But it is getting more and more, and I know this is a private company, but I don't know if this is under the influence of the new healthcare bill. I tend to think it is. I've never seen anything like this in my life, and I've been dealing with this condition my whole life. I know environment is an issue, but this really terrifies me. I'm terrified of people coming to my home, pouring through my things, trying to tell me the minutiae of my life, trying to tell me, I don't know if they're trying to tell me what I could wear or what vitamins I could take or if I could have a pet in my house or if I have to have an air purifier or a dehumidifier, which are, those are all good ideas and that's fine. But I'm really horrified by this, and I just see how our society is moving towards Big Brother, and it's just faster than, or more extreme than I imagined. And so I've been very stressed about this, and my doctor said to me something very scary. He said to me, it's voluntary, I think. So he thinks it's voluntary, but he's not even sure totally. I do believe it is voluntary, at least right now, and I don't know if it always will be. So I just wanted to tell everybody about this and how really violated I feel. I feel like I don't have any private space. I mean, I have my books and I have things like the white book, just books, but I want my privacy, honestly, and oh, some collectibles, and that's it. But I just obviously would like privacy, and I don't know where to find that anymore. So I just wanted to talk to you about this evening and how alarmed I am. So thank you for listening. And maybe you want to be aware of this in your own lives, because maybe you have some insurance policy or some condition where they might justify putting you under some kind of surveillance. They are more circumspect in answering questions, even if you think it's your insurance company. So thank you for listening.
This is Greg Lake.
They said there'll be snow at Christmas. They said there'll be peace on earth, but instead it just kept on raining, a veil of tears for the virgin birth. I remember one Christmas morning, winter's light and a distant choir, and the peal of a bell and that Christmas tree smell, and eyes full of tinsel and fire.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who was inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family until he saw the opportunity to help the Bureau destroy an outspoken critic of the regime. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property, in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. These conversations appear even to a layman who first hears them to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to state categorically for the record that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense lawyer, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. In September of 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years for fraud. So there is some comfort in hoping that the bent brief may die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. Interestingly enough, McAllister himself was a former United States attorney and prosecutor, which gives you some idea of the typical moral character of the people in the federal judiciary. For whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained either to Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed somebody off really bad, although I don't see how. Ed had announced plans to run for governor of Idaho, but he subsequently withdrew from the Idaho governor's race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the dictatorship. Edgar Steele is being held, we think, in the Victorville facility, which is well known through the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. Now, I have finally heard from someone close to the family, and he has confirmed that no one has, in fact, personally heard from Edgar Steele in almost 6 months now. His mail has been simply disappearing without response. And recently, my own mail to Edgar started to be returned to me, marked undeliverable as addressed. Now, since the triple-checked address and email is precisely the one listed on the Bureau of Prisons website for inmates, there is no way to tell what's happened to Ed. He may be in solitary. He may be in the infirmary, he may have been secretly moved to another prison, or he may be dead from his heart condition, or because the dictatorship simply murdered him in his cell one night. We have no way of knowing. I have also had Cindy Steele's present situation explained to me, and it's pretty damn vile, and it makes me even more ashamed than usual to be an American, if that's possible. But given the movement's habit of shooting the messenger, I don't think I should be the first one to come out with this horror story. I hope that she will herself. I'm now going to play for you part of a podcast that Edgar Steele made in February of 2008, not 2007 like it says on the audio, as you can tell from Ed's reference to the 2008 Super Tuesday election.
Mm. My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's February 17, 2007, and today's piece is entitled First Annual State of the Revolution, a Report to the American People. You know, it seems only fair to me. A couple of weeks ago, our so-called president got his say. Then the so-called Democrats gave their response. Now, all that's missing is the truth. I intend to give at least part of that to you today. What's more, I see this State of the Revolution report being necessary at least once each year until it no longer is necessary because America has ceased to exist, or until it no longer is possible, likely because I'm dead or in jail. Others will pick up the standard in that event. I have deferred release of this for a time, just in case the Super Tuesday primary elections might have allowed us to have something resembling a real election take place. They didn't. And the time has allowed me to mull over the significance of what I saw occur. Now here's the executive summary for those who simply must get back to Jeopardy after the break. Basically, we're screwed, and we're simply waiting for them to start shooting us so that we can shoot them back. The morons who seized control of America after killing JFK have botched everything so badly that there is no way back, not involving extensive pain and deprivation at a minimum. And they certainly will not cede the power they have stolen from us peacefully. More likely, bloodshed and death far in excess of that seen during America's first civil war per capita. Why should we suffer for their mistakes and intentional misconduct? Because we let them get away with it, that's why. In recent years, we pulled the levers for Bush, then Clinton, then Bush, and now Clinton again, calling each the lesser of evils. Though we always have had men like Ron Paul available to us, men whom we have dismissed as having no serious chance at becoming president. Else, we watched while they pulled the levers for us and pretended not to notice the obvious vote fraud. Same result, exactly, in any event. I pledged my troth to Ron Paul as a last-ditch effort, just as I always said. Indeed, already I had come to the conclusion that voting was a waste of time, but I wanted just one last swing at the ball before calling the game altogether. Well, the fat lady has sung, as they say. Every single primary caucus and election this year has been tainted by evidence of fraud. Coincidence? Could be. Or it could be fraud. Come on, wake up and smell the corruption in the air. Ron Paul has all this massive support, far as the eye can see, and he draws precisely 3 or 4% of the vote in each and every election? Yeah, right. I receive emails from list members who have participated, as officials, in various state primary elections and caucuses. All say the same thing. Fraud is taking place on all fronts. That was obvious the day after New Hampshire when one family called the game after seeing its entire precinct generate precisely 0 vote for Ron Paul, though they all voted for him. That was the same election in which we learned that the vote matched the polls just in the precincts where ballots were hand-counted. Precisely, just those precincts, too. While in all the others, where Diebold machines were used, voters apparently lied about for whom they intended to vote. Super Tuesday's elections patently were fraudulent, but already you aren't hearing about them anymore. Go to the online version of today's piece for a number of references that are buried, and I'm not even going to point most of them out, but I do want to point out that there are 3 important ones listed at this point in today's piece that you ought to pursue just to show to yourself that there is rampant fraud taking place in these elections. Then, of course, there's the matter of those polls, those jiggered poll numbers themselves, particularly since we began to make so much noise about them. And then there was the marginalization of Dr. Paul in the debates. So painfully obvious, particularly after Fox News got so badly skewered for having excluded him altogether from one debate. The evidence is everywhere, if you are but willing to see it. No matter now, though, because Dr. Paul effectively has withdrawn, and with millions of those dollars unspent, the dollars that we gave him to fight the good fight in our name. His staff announced seeing no evidence of vote fraud in New Hampshire in explaining why they never challenged any of what was so painfully obvious to the rest of us. In leaving the building, here's what Dr. Paul stated. Quote, "With Romney gone, the chances of a brokered convention are nearly zero. But that does not affect my determination to fight on, in every caucus and primary remaining, and at the convention for our ideas, with just as many delegates as I can get. But with so many primaries and caucuses now over, we do not now need so big a national campaign staff, and so I am making it leaner and tighter. Of course, I'm committed to fighting for our ideas within the Republican Party, so there will be no third-party run. I do not denigrate third parties, just the opposite, and I have long worked to remove the ballot access restrictions upon them. But I am a Republican, and I will remain a Republican. I also have another priority. I have constituents in my home district that I must serve. I cannot and will not let them down. And I have another battle I must face here as well. If I were to lose the primary for my congressional seat, all our opponents would react with glee and pretend it was a rejection of our ideas. I cannot and will not let that happen. Close quote. That was contained in an email that I received entitled Message from Ron on February 8th. And yeah, I know it sounds reasonable. Too reasonable. Remember, this is the same guy who refused to spend the money we gave him to go after all the obvious election fraud. That was the only way he possibly could have put right the process and gotten a level playing field, but he wouldn't do it. We gave him the money to accomplish it. He chose not to do it. Go figure. Ron Paul is history. Get over it. So is the upcoming election. What I find amazing is that his grassroots organization still is blindly flailing about like a newly headless chicken, raising money, holding meetups, and talking up the possibility of a brokered convention. Though McCain already has effectively sewn up the nomination. What does it matter whether the next president is Hillary, McCain, or Obama? They all serve the same master as George Bush. It's going to be more of the same. More killing in the Middle East, more death for our children, more tyranny, more poverty for us, and more money for the bankers. Now I'm torn between advocating not voting altogether and voting for the one person likely to bring America into total chaos most quickly, so that we can get it over with, of course. So who will win? Who cares? Seriously. Oh, all right. At this point, it may appear that the Democrats are torn between Hillary and Obama, but even Clinton faithful James Carville now acknowledges that Hillary likely is doomed. This is of some import because McCain, the third liberal still running for president, seems likely to beat Clinton. Only lately does it appear that Obama can do what Hillary cannot and dump McCain. In fact, the surprising rock star-like momentum building behind Obama is beginning to resemble a freight train that may prove impossible to derail. It's surprises like this that cause those who run America to ensure that only those whom they approve in advance actually get a ticket to the dance. Tickets obviously denied this time around to the likes of Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, and Alan Keyes. Thus, the Democrat leadership is allowing Titanic Hillary to founder. Yes, I know that a year ago I said that the powers that be never would allow Obama to win, but now I am recanting and conclude that they likely have decided that only Obama will give the American public the lasting impression of having chosen their own president. You see, McCain versus Clinton really is just an exercise in people voting against candidate, because both have such incredibly negative public images. Though I foresee a last-ditch effort to discredit Obama and thereby get the guy inaugurated whom our self-chosen masters really want, McCain, I predict that Barack Obama will be the next American president. In fact, there is an odd cult-like status being accorded Obama just now by some that could produce a massive win for him and lead to his inauguration being a near coronation. The reality of an Obama presidency, however, will be quite another thing. In fact, nobody could do anything to make things better. As I've noted before, Obama possibly could be the best thing to happen to white voters in a long time, but nobody can pull America from her headlong rush toward oblivion. Like a giant dinosaur who has blundered into quicksand, the more America flails about, the more certain becomes her inevitable demise. Only Ron Paul would have done anything constructive, and his prescription would have resulted in an immediate depression, for which he likely would have been impeached or assassinated anyway. Because America quite obviously is finished, it simply no longer matters who gets elected president. Though every year under Bush the Lesser has chronicled an incredible erosion of personal and civil liberties throughout America.
Since we are coming up to Christmas, I think I'm going to tell you my favorite Christmas story. World War I was one of the most horrific experiences that Western man and Western civilization has ever undergone. And in many respects, it was worse, I think, than World War II, because it came at the end of almost a century of virtually unbroken peace and prosperity and economic and cultural growth in Europe. Now, sure, there were a few hiccups, like the Franco-Prussian War, but basically, for almost 100 years, everything was pretty much on an even keel, and the white man was free to be all that he can be, especially in such places as Germany, Great Britain and her colonies, and here in America. One of the saddest stories in history, I believe, is the story of the Christmas Truce of 1914. Now, this occurred on Christmas Eve of 1914, 5 months into the war, when men on both sides of the trenches stopped fighting and held spontaneous Christmas celebrations instead. No official ceasefire was declared, but more than 100,000 British, French, and German troops participated in the unofficial truce along the length of the Western Front. The truce began with Christmas carols. The German troops had put candlelit Christmas trees on the trench parapets in many places along the front, and at 11 o'clock, which was midnight in Berlin, many of them began to sing Stille Nacht, Silent Night. The British soldiers listened, and then responded with carols of their own. Then the soldiers started shouting Christmas greetings to each other across the barbed wire. And from there on, it went to general comments and conversation, which was possible because in some cases those damn trenches were so close that it was actually possible to communicate over the distance. Now, gradually, men on both sides of the trenches put down their weapons and started spontaneous Christmas celebrations. Their officers ordered the men to keep shooting, but the truce spread all up and down the front lines. Men climbed from the trenches to shake hands in no man's land. They shared food packages from home, traded gifts and souvenirs such as buttons and hats, and they ate and drank together. On Christmas morning, the soldiers again sang Christmas carols, and signboards dotted the trenches. Since more German soldiers spoke English than English soldiers spoke German, the signs were written mostly in English. Sometimes the English was simple, like, "You no fight, we no fight." Men exchanged cigarettes, chocolates, cakes, sausages, and Germans in one sector even rolled out a barrel of beer into the middle of no man's land to share with the British and the French. The soldiers played football and enjoyed the freedom to move about without danger. The truce also allowed burial parties to safely retrieve recently fallen soldiers and bring them back to their lines. Both sides held joint services for their fallen comrades. In many sectors, the Christmas 1914 truce lasted through Christmas night, and in others, it lasted until New Year's Day. In years to come, the officers on both sides made sure that there was no repetition of the informal truce by ordering huge bombardments all along the Western Front, beginning on Christmas Eve, that always lasted through Christmas Day. This episode has always haunted me because it was probably the last time in history that Germans and Englishmen met as equals and friends. Now, from then on, the curtain of Jewish propaganda descended, and the poison of it still hangs in the air between Germany and the rest of the world like a gas attack in the trenches. Anyway, in memory of that night and day, 98 years ago, when our two peoples last exchanged the hands of friendship without a wall of filthy Jewish lies to divide us, this is an unnamed German boys' choir that I was able to find on the internet, and this is the song that began the Christmas truce of 1914. Okay, guys, like I said, I don't want to get too heavy during this show because Christmas is coming and all you guys are going to be paying even less attention to what I say than you usually do. So let's field an email or two. This one is from Tyler in somewhere, Illinois, I think. Sorry, Tyler, I've forgotten. Dear HAC, why do you not like democracy, Harold? Why do you say that the only purpose of democracy is to prevent change? Signed, Tyler. Dear Tyler, well, let's take a look at this. I should start out with a saying that I've heard attributed variously to Alexis de Tocqueville and Benjamin Franklin, but as nearly as I can determine, it was first stated by a Scottish economist and political philosopher in the late 18th century called Alexander Robeson. I quote, "Democracy always fails eventually when men discover that they can vote themselves money from the public funds." Now, think about this in light of the reality of the system that we have today. Democracy fails when men discover that they can vote themselves money from the public funds. Now, that describes in a nutshell what the American system of government has pretty much always been about since this country's founding, but especially since the beginning of the 20th century. And indeed, what every modern liberal democratic government is about, and has been about ever since before World War I. American government and liberal Western democratic style government, be it in the British Parliament or in Australia or Spain or wherever, is all about the money. Who collects it and from whom, and who decides who gets how much of it. In this country, even more so than the others. Now, we're talking about what is still, despite 4 years of depression, the greatest economic pie and the greatest hoard of wealth in the world. The United States Treasury, replenished every year by the American taxpayer. Now, when you look at history, and I mean real history, not the silly crap that we see on TV and in Hollywood with sword-swinging bimbos and armored bikinis, what we see is that so-called democracy really isn't. Down through the millennia, in those democracies which survived for any length of time, the franchise was always heavily restricted, usually by property and wealth requirements, to make sure that those who voted had some kind of stake in society, and to prevent this modern phenomenon, the very thing we're dealing with today, of greedy bastards and thieves seizing control of the governmental process so that they can vote themselves money from the public funds. There was a brief experiment in ancient Greece of giving every Tom, Dick, and Harry the vote simply by virtue of their having two arms and two legs and a noggin. In fact, archaeologists have even unearthed primitive ballots from the Acropolis in Athens with the names of famous Greek statesmen and politicians like Pericles written on pottery shards. And of course, the system failed for the same reason that today's democracy has failed. But since Athens was so much smaller and more poor than America and didn't have all our resources and our wide open spaces and our vibrant free enterprise system in the early formative years, Athens went down quick and hard. The so-called golden age of democracy in Athens actually lasted less than 30 years before the badass Spartans, who were ruled by a king, finally stomped on it and won the Peloponnesian War and occupied Athens for several generations. That particular period of history is, in fact, fairly well documented, as much as any period in the ancient world is. And basically, the Athenians discovered that not only is democracy corrupt, it's inefficient, and it leads to military disaster. The next people who tried this whole voting thing actually did a lot better. But the Romans very pointedly created a republic, not a democracy. There was a constitution and a whole system of government that was laid out on a kind of a plutocratic basis, and indeed their whole society was divided openly into two classes, the rich and the poor. The wealthy and the well-educated patricians who ran things, and the plebeians or plebeians who did all the work. They had their famous Senate, from which our own exclusive Gentlemen's Club on the Potomac gets its name. But in order to be a member of the Senate, you had to meet the property and wealth requirements in both land and cash. And at least during the first 500 years or so of Rome, you had to be a member of one of the traditional senatorial patrician families as well. Although, later on, up-and-coming social-climbing characters like Gaius Marius got to the point where they could start buying their way in without having the family connections, and this is supposedly where the fall of Rome first began, blah blah blah, but we won't get into all that. Anyway, the whole Roman form of government was specifically designed to prevent one man from taking over and making himself king or dictator. That's true. The Romans had the office of dictator. In fact, they invented it, but that was a very temporary thing that was given to one man in time of existential crisis when the barbarians were literally at the gates. Dictators ruled for a matter of a few months, and then they, in theory, resigned office and went back to their plow, blah, blah, blah. Of course, you had the case of Sulla, which I got into in my Arian History series, and we won't get into all that. Anyway, the Roman Republic was not ruled by a president, but by two consuls at once, so that no one man ever held all the power. And the consuls were re-elected every year, along with a number of other officials with funny Latin names, and also along with two tribunes from the plebs or the plebes, who had the power to veto legislation from the Senate to make sure that the patricians didn't ride roughshod over the workers and the peasants and whatnot. You ever hear the expression tribune of the people? Well, this is where it comes from. Of course, eventually the system collapsed, and one man did end up overthrowing the Republic and making himself king, or rather emperor, and that was Caesar Augustus. Now, you may recall that Augustus's uncle, Julius Caesar, also tried it, and he came damn close to making himself king and establishing one-man rule, but the senators themselves combined to stick his ass full of dagger blades right on the floor of the Senate. Now, I wonder, if I were to make any parallels between Julius Caesar and Barack Hussein Obama, am I going to get a knock on my door? In this increasingly paranoid society, which is now sliding into a one-party dictatorship, one never knows. Now, Obama has already shown himself willing to completely ignore the Constitution, and he's been allowed to get away with it. So, if I speak of another dictator 2,000 years ago who wasn't allowed to get away with it, does that get me a prison cell in Guantanamo? I guess we'll find out. And that's another point, Tyler. What I feel about democracy doesn't really matter anymore because we no longer live in one. Now, I wasn't joking just now. It is entirely possible that I or anyone else whom Obama decides he wants to destroy can be dragged out of their home in secret, tortured for information or to force a confession in secret, sent out of the country to some foreign prison where they can be held without trial and tortured some more in secret, and maybe even executed in secret without trial on the order of the president or other quote-unquote competent federal authority, which as nearly as I can determine begins with your average U.S. attorney sitting in some cubicle somewhere. Now, all of this could be done legally, although I believe the mercenaries do officially require an order from the president himself to actually kill someone without trial. Or maybe not. No one seems to be clear on just what the National Defense Authorization Act 2011 does mean. It's possible that the director of the FBI or the United States Attorney in Seattle could legally send the FBI gunman to my home with orders to simply shoot me when I open the door and walk away and leave me lying there. No, I am not kidding, and I am not exaggerating, and I am not making this up, dammit. The Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act of 2006, the National Defense Authorization Act, everything I have just said is completely legal now and entirely possible and enshrined in the laws of the United States. Now, true, the dictator hasn't yet ordered any American citizens murdered in this country, although we know he's killed 3 or 4 Americans on foreign soil, as well as dozens of other targeted assassinations of foreign nationals. At least, we don't think he's ordered any Americans arbitrarily murdered here in this country yet. But, since it could all be done secretly and still be entirely within the law if Barry, or some U.S. attorney, or some federal bureaucrat whom nobody knows, is having people killed and their bodies spirited away or whatever, we wouldn't necessarily know about it, would we? Now, Tyler, you want to know what I have against democracy? Well, now you know. Democracy doesn't work. Because the simple and undeniable fact of human history and human nature is that the majority of people are too stupid and too self-centered and narcissistic to govern themselves. And anyone who panders to them and flatters them and buys their votes and tries to convince them to give him power that he is unable to earn or to take on his own merits is a scumbag who has no business exercising any power over the lives of others. As someone once said, anyone who uses democracy deliberately to seek power over others should never be allowed to have it. No matter how many checks and balances people put in place, eventually you get a Julius Caesar or a Napoleon or a Barack Hussein Obama who grabs the wheel. Always remember, out of democracy steps the cruelest of tyrants, because they are the tyrants who robe themselves in hypocrisy, and hypocrisy renders all sin 10 times worse. Okay, tell you what, I've gotten a week behind with Gretchen's stuff, and she sent in a Christmas piece this week, which I really can't hold over, so let's get Gretchen back for a bit.
Good evening, comrades. You know, lately I've been thinking about what might be Christmassy and seasonal to discuss, and there is a story that's on Stormfront, and it's on a lot of other websites, called It's a Wonderful Race. And of course, this is based on It's a Wonderful Life. There are several versions of this story. It's always about this young man who is a college student, and sometimes his name is George, and sometimes it's Eric. And he buys into this idea that the white race is no good. And he's often quarreling with his father, and he's very disrespectful. He's kind of a know-it-all. Then he always meets an angel or a Valkyrie, and he gets shown what the world would be like with no white people in it. This is a world where no white people ever existed at all. He starts out in North America, and he's always asking for something. He asks for matches or a car or something like that, and he's never able to get these things that he wants because these things really don't exist. And so then he finds he wants to go to South America, but he has no way to get there, so he has to cheat and touch the angel's robe or the Valkyrie's robe. And then, at least in the Stormfront version, he's taken to South America, where he's horrified by all the human sacrifices going on. And then he wants to go to Africa. There's a really funny scene where he meets Martin Luther King, who in this story is a witch doctor. And the witch doctor, depending on which version of the story you read, is always trying to harm him, and then he vanishes just before the witch doctor can perform whatever ritual the witch doctor would like to perform. And then he decides to go to North Africa to see Egypt. And he finds there is no Egypt, that there was no one to build the pyramids, because he finds that the ancient Egyptians were basically Caucasian. Then he asks about Europe, and he finds out that Europe was settled by Asiatic tribes, and there's really nothing there except people living in tents and being nomads, much like they live in North America. So then he decides he's going to go to China or Japan, and in one of the versions, he learns about the Chenyang mummies, the Caucasian mummies that were out there in China, that were found, I think, 6,000 years ago in China. I would have to look that up, but of course they're very famous. And finally, in the Stormfront version, Eric decides that he's going to go to Japan. He's able to live there. They have a fairly stagnant agricultural society, but they do have a livable society, and he's able to get rice and fish. He finds out that he's actually from South Africa, because there are no white people on Earth in this story, but he's actually a young black man from South Africa. And he is sentenced to staying in Japan for a while, but finally he appeals to the gods in the Stormfront version, and there's various different versions. He cries out for help. Then suddenly everything turns back to the way it was before, and suddenly he's white again, and he ends up finding that he's at home and he's in the shower, and he finds that there's soap and water, and he's very grateful to have that, and he no longer disrespects his father. He realizes that even though his father is just a humble plumber, that plumbing is a wonderful thing. And in the Stormfront version, it's rather funny because he starts singing in various different languages. And then he goes to a restaurant, and in the Stormfront version, he eats French fries and lasagna, which I think is rather funny because I think it shows a great love for starch. You know, I think they're good separately, but I wouldn't necessarily eat them together because it would be too bready and too starchy in one meal. But in other versions, he has eggplant parmesan and some other thing, I can't quite remember what, and then he has apple strudel, and that makes a bit more sense. So this is a fun story. It's very entertaining and, again, a bit comical, especially in the Stormfront version, because this Eric is very oblivious of what's going on, and somehow this relationship with his girlfriend somehow blossoms, even though he's totally oblivious of everything around him and is in another dimension for several months. And so I found that aspect also rather comical, although I'm sure that's unintended. But because it's the holiday season, I was just thinking of something festive to bring up on this show. You know, I was totally unrelated. I'm thinking about the holiday. You know, I think if I lived in Australia, I think I would want to celebrate Christmas in June rather than in December, because this is really such a solstice-based holiday. And it really has so much to do with the rebirth of the sun that I think it must be rather strange, because I was reading an article from Australia about how it was a summer solstice, and that makes no sense for the Christmas holiday at all. So I would really reschedule it if I lived down there. So at any rate, I know this is the Christmas season, and we're all looking for a bit of a break. And I just thought that this would be just an entertaining topic. And I would also say that this story is very much like March of the Titans, but it's much briefer, so it's much less intimidating to read. So I hope you enjoyed this week's contribution, and thank you very much for listening. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
A friend of mine in England sent me an MP3 of a song called Christmas in Rhodesia, which I deeply appreciate, but I've decided not to play that because I figure I've wallowed enough in maudlin nostalgia recently. Instead, I've decided to play for you once again the greatest of all American Christmas carols, the song that expresses for three generations more clearly than any other the quintessential experience of an American holiday season.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. She'd been drinking too much eggnog, and we begged her not to go, but she forgot her medication, and she staggered out the door into the snow. When we found her Christmas morning at the scene of the attack, she had hoof prints on her forehead and incriminating claws marks on her back. Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. Now we're all so proud of Grandpa, he's been taking this so well. See him in there watching football, drinking beer and playing cards with Cousin Mel. It's not Christmas without Grandma. All the family's dressed in black, and we just can't help but wonder, should we open up her gifts or send them back?
Send them back!
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. Now the goose is on the table, and the pudding made of fig.
Ah!
And the blue and silver candles, that would just have matched the hair in Grandma's wig. I've warned all my friends and neighbors, better watch out for yourselves. They should never give a license to a man who drives a sleigh and plays with elves. Grandma got run over by a reindeer walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
Sing it, Grandpa!
Grandma got run over by a reindeer walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
Okay, running along again. Well, time flies when you're having fun. But I'm sure by the time you're actually listening to this, you're going to have all kinds of Christmas stuff you got to run out and do, so I'll let you get to it. Seriously, guys, enjoy the holidays this year, because as much as I hate to be a downer and a bah humbug type, the year that's coming on January the 1st ain't going to be very nice for anybody. As of November the 6th, normal people are now a minority in this country, and we are living in a one-party state where we don't have a damn thing to say about whatever the one party decides to do. Now, the period of outright tyranny that right-wingers have been muttering to themselves about for generations has finally begun. And at the same time, America's bill is coming due in every sense of the word. Now, the only way the Democrats have been able to pull this off is through massive amounts of taxed, borrowed, and newly printed money. But they can't keep it up. The minute they run out of money or the money they print becomes worthless, all hell is going to break loose. And although I myself have never been one of these movement doomsayer types, I really think that we are now within sight of that happening in a conceivable future. And on that cheery note, Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night. Our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.